Hello and welcome. This specially created podcast comes from you from day three of the 2017 Festival of Astronomy in Space, hosted by the University of Southern Queensland. I'm your host Mitch Drake, and joining me today is Peter Miller, sound designer and multimedia artist, Jake Clark, PhD student, focusing on exoplanet habitability, and Amy Balding, head of lifelong learning at the Queensland Museum Network. Welcome, guys.
Hello. Thank you. Hi.
Yes, it's great to see so much support for this. So we were going through a bit before the show, kind of discussing the history of the event. And Jake, you've had so pretty decent insight into that. So previously the winter
astronomy festival? Yeah, so previously it started all last year, so back in 2016. Mm-hmm. Cast your mind back to when we had SANE leaders around the world.
It's hard to remember.
It's very, very hard to remember. And we started off having the winter astronomy festival.
Yeah.
That was pretty much smack bang in the middle of winter. And we found out that it's probably not the best time to run an astronomy festival, because even though if the sky is nice and clear, you have the nice spread of the Milky Way galaxy, but what you also have is pesty little clouds and rain, which obviously, you know, having a telescope down on the ground, you can't see through those pesky clouds. So we tried to move it and to align it with the International Space Week, which is this week as well. But unfortunately, the first week that we've had some rain here in Toowoomba for months is, you guessed it, this week. So
stargazing's out of the question for the moment.
Stargazing, well, it's about a 50-50 chance tomorrow, so we'll see.
Okay, excellent. And there's been talk so far, including talk earlier, well, yesterday by Peter Miller, which I was lucky enough to get into the Zoom meeting on.
Oh, good.
That went really well. Would you like to tell us a bit about your works?
Yeah, well, look, I won't, because we're in an astronomy podcast, I won't talk too much about it, because my work spans a lot of stuff, and the work you saw yesterday is kind of a sort of a different, slightly different direction. Mm-hmm. But I've had a very long interest in science, and science informs quite a lot of my work. So I do music work, I do image work. Mm-hmm. And this is my own personal work, by the way, because as a professional, I kind of just do the work that people point me at, but you know, my own personal work, yeah. So very, very interested in these.
So science is very important to you.
Very important, yes.
Absolutely. How did you get that interest? And I'll extend the question to the rest of you as well. What started your interest in science?
I loved it from school. I mean, I couldn't even tell you. I've been, you know, that kid. Mm-hmm. From when I was at school, I took all the science I could take when I was at school. Back in those long dark. My high school actually ran a multi-strand science course, so I could take physics, chemistry and biology, all of which I did take. Never look back. I loved it.
Mm. Is that kind of feelings that are shared across the board, or is there...
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, as children we are naturally curious, and science is a tool that can help us extend that curiosity into adulthood and beyond. So I think for me it did start back then, you know, finding out interesting new things that other people just didn't know about.
And your work currently is kind of reflective of that.
My work currently continues to try and help people explore their curiosities and discover new things, make new connections, make meaning of the world in ways that they may not have previously done so. So I think the act of science as questioning, predicting, experimenting, that is a lifelong thing. Mm. And the facts of science are sometimes what make people get a bit shy. So I'm so happy to see a festival that's talking about astronomy, which is a little bit abstract for a lot.
It is.
But actually making it really relatable and relevant and engaging so that people can connect with that as well.
Mm-hmm. And astronomy is such a hard thing, because you have those beautiful images where people go, oh, this is great, and there's such a disconnect between enthusiasts which just grab out their telescope, look at the beauty of the stars, and the physicists that sort of delve into that mathematics and try and really understand, well, how is that nebula pink and purple in the first place? Mm. But going along the lines of, I mean, as a kid growing up, I would always just keep asking why. And I mean, you get to that sort of 3-year-old level and you keep asking those questions. And I think I just didn't have that beaten out of me, and I kept asking those questions and why, 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 why. And I come from a background where my parents finished school in year 10. They're like, no, that's it. Where they didn't have that background, but they had the passion and the drive to fuel my love for science and continue that on. And so I only got the internet like 2 years ago back at home. And so I'd go down to the library and print stuff off, and we would go in the back of the shed and build little models of the solar system and that. And so just having that sort of support really helps as a kid to just drive that curiosity and you know, then study the stars 25 odd years later.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting thing about, you know, the shared stories is that in different people's experience of science, it is sometimes textbook based, but a lot of the time it is about getting out there and being in the world as well as understanding the world. So for me, I went into freshwater ecology as career number one because I realised that I could get a job that meant I could play outside. And that to me was the best thing ever. I get paid to play in the mud?
Right.
What? Awesome. And equally, when you're out there with a telescope, it's not looking at a screen, it's not looking in a book, it's looking at something that's real and tangible and can have impact on you.
For sure. And I guess now with technology being where it is now, unfortunately, most astronomers and astrophysicists don't actually look at a telescope anymore. We just see the screens that the telescope is seeing through CCD lenses, which is then going through some optical fiber, which, you know,
it kind of distills the process.
Yes,
a
it does.
You're looking
at
data rather than the real impact of reality, I guess.
We tend to forget that science once upon a time was something that anybody could do. I mean, it still is, obviously, but now we have all these machines that do stuff, and so it's daunting for a lot of people to think, you know, science is this thing that's way up there that I couldn't even get at. But, you know, we remember things like Charles Darwin looking in his compost bin at worms. I mean, you know, he was doing science, and we can still do that kind of science. And I think the kind of astronomy thing that you're doing tomorrow night is a great example of that. I mean, this is like science that Galileo was doing. Mm-hmm. You go outside, you look through a telescope at the sky, or not even through a telescope.
Culturally, the space sciences have been very impactful on humanity as a whole.
Right.
Like, from as far back as Stonehenge to, like, the space race of the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
Are we still seeing that kind of passion in culture at the moment, or are we kind of focused on what's going on here, do you think?
It's a really good question.
No one's going to go there.
Yeah. The first thing that came to mind when you said that was the recent announcement about Australia having a space agency. I saw a beautiful T-shirt, Australian Research and Space Exploration.
The ARSE, yes.
Which I think, yes, it's just pop culture fluff, but it provides another way for people to actually get genuinely inspired and enthusiastic about the direction that we're taking with this.
Yeah.
It might be better if it actually existed, but I think with stuff like the Big Bang Theory and other such pop culture references, it is still part of the conversation. We do definitely have an issue, though, in this post-truth era where perhaps the rigour of science isn't as respected as it should be. But I think in terms of the progression of space science, it is still providing some of the most mind-blowing things to us. You know, Cassini's images, oh my God, can't believe it. Like, that's incredible foresight. You know, what, 1970s? That provides inspiration today that will help us continue on in supporting this kind of work.
Going on from the topic of inspiration, all three of you are here because of your childhood, because of that, but you're continued learning. Like you said, you've been inspired to work outside and be paid for it, to play in the mud. But inspiration is a very valuable thing to both science and creative arts because they're very, very similar.
Very, very similar.
Are there any notable works or people that have kind of inspired you in what you're doing? Or is that a very tough question?
My answer is really not the one you'd expect.
Oh?
I am constantly inspired by very small children because they ask the biggest, best questions.
Some of the best questions coming from the mouths of children.
Exactly. It's all about, but why? But how do you know? It's like, that's a... yes! Everybody asked those critical thinking questions. Yes! So I'm frequently inspired by tiny people who surprise me with questions that I can't answer, and I love that.
Yeah, look, the whole science and art thing has been very interesting for me. You know, I do have favourite artists who kind of blend those areas, but I just have to say that really for me it's just history. You know, my wife makes cyanotypes, and which is a form of photography that needs a kind of a chemical that leaves this lovely blue image on the paper. Well, cyanotypes, we know them better as blueprints because that's what they were used for such a long time. But the process of cyanotyping was invented by Sir John Herschel, who was an astronomer. And so, you know, scientists actually did really incredible things that were artistic. Mm-hmm. It's just that we don't tend to make that link so much, although in recent times it has become something where, you know, you're seeing many, many more artists being informed by science. Mm. But, you know, truly to me, art and science are kind of the same thing. You know, they're so blended together, in my work at least, that I don't make big definitions of one and the other. Mm-hmm. I don't see it like, it's not like you're a scientist and I'm an artist. I mean, yeah. I don't see why we can't all be.
Well, that's the reason that you're all on this panel together.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your work in the public domain has brought you to kind of see that kind of history.
Yes.
Have you noticed any patterns emerging through your...
Well, this is kind of a relatively new kind of area, and that is that, you know, public domain work... This is public domain, just to explain very briefly, is work that's not bound by copyright. So we have this kind of system where we copyright things so that people can't take an idea and use it as their own idea and make money out of it. It's purely a financial thing. There's no other reason for copyright to exist. But we have copyright on certain things expires and goes into the public domain, which means anybody has access to it and anybody can use it. And for instance, a lot of people don't know that anything that NASA produces is in the public domain. So all images that NASA produce, all sounds that they produce, movies, anything that appears on a NASA website basically is usable by anybody else for inspiration, recreation and reinvention. So over the years, NASA is probably the most well-known of those organisations that does that kind of thing, but over these last few years, lots of libraries, lots of places who are archival institutions mm-hmm. have started to find public domain work and put it there on the internet, and that's the big secret, because now anybody can go there and visit this stuff.
You don't have to go to the Smithsonian and dig through.
Yeah. Absolutely. So many people who have worked with anybody who's done any kind of artwork or anything and needs space images, they've used NASA images pretty mm-hmm. much, and they know it's copyright free because they don't have to pay anyone, they don't have to think about it. You know, so you know, every time you see like the moon in a photograph or something that's not been taken by somebody, it's probably a NASA photograph mm-hmm. of the moon. But all of the others, you know, there is a lot of other public domain work that is now becoming available, which is much more obscure than that. Mm-hmm. And it tends to be things that I'm personally interested in just because of the kind of interest I have, but documentaries and things that have been made about space or medicine or all kinds of things which were made, say, in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, where we know more about that stuff now. So mm-hmm. when you look back on those things now, you kind of go, probably not a good idea to to put that sort of stuff in someone's veins. Kind of kill them. We know that now. So that's my fascination with the public domain, is that mm-hmm. we're seeing a kind of little slices of history that don't make it into now because they're extraneous. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm kind of interested in folding that stuff back into my work.
Mm-hmm. You can see that now on the academic side where, you know, journals would always have a paywall. And
right.
And especially in astronomy and physics, most researchers put their stuff up on a open source archive where anyone can have a look at it before it gets published in a journal. Mm. So anyone, if they're really, really keen and love their science and STEM, then they can just go on that website, download the article, and then they can reproduce those results entirely without the need to, you know, pay for journal subscriptions and all of that.
Yeah, and in my opinion, that's you know, that's how all kind of knowledge of the kind of knowledge we accumulate as humanity should be like that, because, you know, you don't want people sitting on these little enclaves of important information and stopping other people from getting it, because who knows, you know, some some kid out there is going to read something and go, you know, I've got an idea about that, and then go on to make major discoveries. So, yeah, I really, truly believe that a lot of that stuff should just be there for everyone.
The open source philosophy has been in debate quite a lot lately, right, as well. Right. Going back to your, would you, post-truth? Era? Yes.
It's not a term I coined.
No.
Nor
thankfully.
Like. But yes. It definitely it's definitely something to contend with at the moment, mm-hmm, in the environment that we work within. Mm.
It's difficult, isn't it, in science though, because there is a kind of a methodology where things need to be established by people who understand what people are writing about. So there's now this trend for things to be published up straight away because they have some level of, voyeuristic interest, and people want to know about this one thing. So you get things like, alien, what's the thing about the star that's got the...
the alien megastructure.
And anyone who kind of studies astronomy or even knows much about astronomy is going to say, that's unlikely to be a Dyson sphere, maybe, but, 0.0000001% chance. But, all the periodicals and Facebook and Twitter and everything run with that story.
Mm. So jumping aliens to something well before it's been confirmed.
And that's the difficulty of science, isn't it? How you make sure things are actually worth putting on the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah, I think the rigour that comes with peer-reviewed journals and the scientific method, but also a true scientist is unlikely to ever say, I know for sure that that is a fact, because they're constantly disproving hypotheses, so they know what's not, they don't know what is, as a fundamental principle. So that means that they can't necessarily say, I have proven X, Y, Z, but a politician's happy to.
Yeah, that's right.
So we do have that disconnect. Mm-hmm.
There's a reason the word theory exists in science and not in politics.
Exactly.
Moving on from the political debate, which is very hard to get away from in this, in most intellectual conversations, I do want to go back to the Queensland Museum Network, and I would love to hear more about what you are doing for the continued learning experiences that you've been running.
So many things! Okay, so I guess as a quick overview, when we're talking about the Queensland Museum Network, we're talking about 4 public-facing museums, one in Toowoomba here at Cobb & Co, one in Ipswich, the Workshops Rail Museum, one in Townsville, Museum of Tropical Queensland, and then the South Bank Campus, which is the Queensland Museum and Science Centre. Mm-hmm. So we've got quite a range of collections, quite a range of exhibitions on display, and it's the job of my team to create experiences and opportunities for people to connect with those collections, the research, the stories, in personally meaningful ways. So in terms of what we have on offer, we do everything from early learning programs through to school holiday family events and opportunities through to school programs. We even have, based in Toowoomba here, our reminiscence program, which is an outreach program taking collection objects to aged care facilities to be able to connect with the residents there.
That's wonderful.
So it really spans the the distance of lifelong. And we also have expertise in both natural and cultural history. So the diversity is quite significant. Much of it does land within the science or STEM field, and that's something that we're actually really quite heavily focused on at the moment, because we have recently been given some extra funding, thank you state government, to redevelop our science centre at South Bank.
Oh, wonderful.
So that will be something that I hope everybody's really looking forward to. We're going to open it mid-next year. It's currently under development, but it will be a shiny new STEM centre with a new look and feel that I'm really excited about.
So what is your involvement in the development of that?
At the moment, it's a little bit of everything. So it's myself and a few other members who are the leads for the content component. So that means everything from figuring out the curatorial framework, so the what exactly we want people to take away from this.
Yeah.
That's the big important thing. And then what is it that we need to have in the space and have in the programming to achieve that? So the everything from the interactive selection, the design, the curriculum linkage, the exhibit labels, the programming experiences. There's a lot of different moving parts. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I can't give away too much. There will be a hint of Earth Space Science, though. And it's looking really good. It's very exciting. And I can't wait to invite you guys all to come and check it out.
That sounds absolutely brilliant. Jake,
I'll be the first one there. At the door. The roller door opens up. I slide through. Press all the buttons.
You look particularly excited about the Earth Space Sciences there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really hard to make an exhibit or even an exhibition based on space science, because you look at these distances, they are incredibly vast. Even the distance between the moon and the Earth is incredible, and something that we can't actually think of in our heads. You know, in Indigenous languages, most counting goes up to 3, and then that's it. We go 1 through 3 lots, and that's the same in your head. Like, in your head, think of, okay, 20 people in a room, and think of 21 people in the room, and conceptually, there isn't much difference. There isn't any difference in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you go 2,324 and 2,323. Like, you know, you just can't picture these numbers in your head. Let alone the distances between stars or galaxies. And just trying to have a exhibition that can sort of bring that all down and make it digestible is super, super exciting.
I can't wait to see, like, any photos or stuff like that that come through from USQ students going out and running a mark. I think you might be in the forefront of all of that.
No comment.
Oh, dear. So, going from lifelong learning and these ideas of the elderly...
Oh, the Reminiscence
Program. Yes. I haven't heard of much interaction between the aged community and sciences before. Is this a relatively new thing? No,
I don't believe so, no. So when it comes to the Reminiscence Program, I suppose it is important to note that it's not strictly science.
Mm-hmm.
It's all sorts of then and now type topics, really. Okay. But the Reminiscence Program has been running for a number of years. I can't tell you exactly how many.
Wow.
It's older than my tenure. but yeah, no, it's a really beautiful program that we're constantly looking for volunteers for, hint hint. so yeah, no, it's something that is very special to our Toowoomba campus.
Excellent. There needs to be much more done for that, I think, because I wish that more people knew about that.
Mm.
Is there a specific component that you're particularly passionate about? Any passion projects that you've... Because everyone's got one of those things. Yeah. You can delegate as much as you want, but there's always one or two things that just...
To be honest, right now, the new STEM centre, the new science centre, is taking up most of my brain space. And like I said, I'm so excited about the direction it's taking. We're still a little ways off being able to confirm any particular details.
Oh.
But our principal exhibition design team are doing phenomenal work.
Mm-hmm.
Our partners at Science Museum Group London have provided some incredible interactives. We're building in some amazing full body experiences. And the thing I'm really honestly passionate about, no matter what particular deliverable we're talking about, is that why question. Mm-hmm. And encouraging people to be okay with not knowing. And being able to explore the things that they're curious about. So for me, this new science centre encapsulates that in such a beautiful, dynamic way that, I've kind of got my blinders on at the moment. It's all about the science centre. Yeah.
Okay. That's wonderful. And if anyone who's listening would like more information on that, is there any websites or particular...
Yeah, check the Queensland Museum Network website. It's constantly updated with whatever information we can share.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely the best place. Otherwise, Facebook and Twitter, we also do update as well.
Okay, I'll get those details off you and put those in the description of this. Anyway, while we're in the plugging mode, would you like to push anything that you're working on?
Well, all my stuff is on my website. It's scribbletronics.com, so pretty much anything I do gets dumped there. Mm-hmm. You just need to go there to find it. I do have there is one project that I did called Watching Europa, which is a strictly science-based piece of art, and it has its own website, so it's called watchingeuropa.com. Mm-hmm. And you can go there and see lots of nice pictures and so speculate about weird things.
While we're on that, could you tell us a little bit more about Watching Europa?
Yeah, Watching Europa, I did a few years ago. So I have a professional career and I kind of takes up a lot of my time, but I also have like this other artistic career where I try and do stuff. And so it took a fairly long time to make this project, but it is based on my love of science, and particularly on the speculation of science, and also on the kind of place that we are in history now, where much of what we learn about the world we don't experience directly. You know, getting back to, you know, Charles Darwin could look in his compost bin, but now if we want to look at Cassini, we have to send something there. Mm-hmm. And we see these things through these amazing pieces of augmentation, this sophisticated technology. So I just had this idea, and I love that. I mean, I was glued to Cassini. I watched the last fiery moments, and well, in my mind, that whole mission of Cassini has meant so much to me over the years, and I love the science that comes back. I listened to Huygens go down. I listened to all the people in the control center just like having the most incredible experience, and experience that with them, because, you know, I don't know everything about what they were mm-hmm. seeing and hearing and the telemetry and stuff, but I certainly can tell that they were really excited about it. So Watching Europa came about as an idea. We are now, we've sent a few craft around Jupiter. We're now very interested in, particularly in the world of the moon of Europa, mm-hmm. And now also Enceladus, right? Because they have water, a lot of water. Mm-hmm. More, we didn't think there was water out there. Once upon a time, in my lifetime, the universe, the solar system was rocky stuff, and water was here. Now we know we're only a little bit of water. All the water's out there. So much water out there. But we figure that there is, a huge ocean underneath the ice of Europa. Mm-hmm. And Watching Europa came about as a little bit of speculation about what would happen if we did send a probe to Europa, and it did, we will send cameras, and we put some cameras down there, and suddenly images started coming back. What would that reaction be? You know, how would we feel if we saw life? Mm-hmm. And that's the focus of that particular project. And I have a memory or an image in my head as I was talking about earlier, where, you know, there's a control room and most people are out for coffee, and there's a cleaner swabbing the floor, and these images start coming up on the screens, and the cleaner is just standing there going, wow, you know, because that's what I am. I feel like I'm that guy, the cleaner. Mm-hmm. I know I'm not a scientist, but I can certainly understand that amazement. And it's not, you know, it's not strictly scientific. It's very impressionistic. I'm not saying this is what we're going to see if we find creatures under Europa. They're just speculations of, stuff.
But you still did use a lot of mathematics to sculpt.
Correct. Yeah. It's all the whole project was created with a piece of image software that does that creates high definition images with mathematics. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah.
Is there any way for people to go and see this work? Because is it an installation?
You can see a lot of it on watchingeuropa.com. Mm-hmm. So you'll get a good idea, and there's a lot of explanation there. So you can kind of see it. But, ultimately I'd love to do an exhibition of it. It's designed to be played on 13 screens. It's like a huge work. Mm-hmm. And the idea, of course, is that people walk into this environment and they're seeing these things happen. It's got sound as well. Mm-hmm. And the 13 strands have a way of working together, which is based on whole theories of randomness and all this stuff that I won't go into. But the idea is that you go into this room and you just experience this kind of, you know, this changing image.
Completely alien.
That's still, you don't know what it is. And see, we would be like that. We see things come back from any of the little robots that we have wandering around now, and a lot of the time the first reaction is, what the hey, you know, what are we seeing there? What is that thing? You know, we see little marbles on Mars. What's that? You know, and it takes some time. Mm-hmm. But the first reaction is always that. It's always like,
wow.
Yeah, and a whole lot of people huddle in a corner and go, and you know, and their coffee goes cold, and they're all going, oh, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the feeling, you know. And I, as a schmuck, as a, just a guy, I feel that I'd like to try and get other people who are not interested in science to feel that feeling, because I think it's what pushes scientists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that sounds wonderful. I will be putting a link and images and. Go yes, and check it out, do. Definitely.
Swipe anything.
I guess that's the best thing about science, right? Is that it's not just the questions that you get to answer, but it's all those questions that come back when you get that answer. It's like, right. How is that happening?
Right, yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, the great thing about science is that we don't run out of questions to ask.
No.
You know,
like, no.
There's always another one.
For every answer, there's 10 more questions.
Every time someone thinks, oh, we've nailed that one down, yeah, Newtonian mechanics, everything explains the lot, you know? And then someone goes, And then suddenly, bang, we're back out in the universe again. And that just keeps on happening and probably will never stop happening.
There's a great story with particle physics, is that there's two competing theories of if you chop an atom down bits and bits and bits and bits, then what do you get left out of it? And there's two competing theories. There's the supersymmetric particle, so every particle, so your protons, your electrons, and going further down to your subatomic particles have a supersymmetric component. And then there's also the string theory, so basically that we're just all vibrating strings. And when they did experiments in the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, the largest particle accelerator in the world, they smashed up these protons and they looked at the energy of the Higgs boson, and they were trying to work out, okay, with this theory, the Higgs boson should be this amount of weight. With this other theory, it should be this amount of weight. Now, guess where the weight lies?
Exactly in the middle. Yeah.
Exactly in the middle. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So they're like, what on earth is happening here? Like, yeah. It can't be one or the other.
Yeah.
So where to from there, sort of thing.
And it's that, you know, that's paralleled all the way through science. You know, is light a particle? Is light a wave? Oh, no, it does both of those things.
Those
are great questions, you know. And whilst those questions still circulate around, you know, we're always kind of pushing forward to kind of find out that little bit more. I think it's, you know, that's the thing that, you know, my first science textbook to now, that's been my path, you know.
Absolutely. And the improvements in technology, and not just improvements, but ridiculous advancements, will help us look further and further, which, while it does provide more answers, the important part is that it actually provides a lot more questions. That's the exciting part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, 25 years ago, we first discovered another planet orbiting another star. And that was 25 years ago. And even preceding when I was in undergrad, there was about 400-odd exoplanets discovered. Now there's about 4,000 discovered in this. So you've had, in the past, say, 5 years, about 3,500 more planets discovered. And that whole field has just exploded, you know.
Yeah.
30-odd years ago, that wasn't even a thing.
Along with the kind of implication of that, and that is that, you know, when there's one, you kind of go, nah. When there's 4,000 and it's everywhere we look, then it's like, oh, okay. So there are probably billions, you know.
But the big question is, what do you think of Pluto?
Back when I was a kid, Pluto was still a planet. It's an interesting premise, and there's Alan Stern, who was the chief scientist for the New Horizons mission. He's on a big charge for, you know, Pluto should be a planet, and he's come out with this theory that, okay, well, if it's round and it hasn't had any nuclear fusion, so if it's not a star and if it's round, it should be a planet. But that argument you could have a bowling ball, you could chuck that up into a geostationary orbit around Earth and then call that a planet. So instead of having 8 planets in the solar system, you'd have literally thousands, you'd have all the moons would be planets. And but the definition that the International Astronomical Union have come up with is a bit sort of wishy-washy as well. So I think there isn't a sort of quantize, like, this is a planet, this is a dwarf planet, and this is a star. I think there's a continuous band of, okay, there's some small sort of protoplanets, and you get the sort of dwarf planets, and you have the planets, and then you'll have brown dwarfs, which are sort of really successful planets, because the people talk to them as failed stars. But I think they're really successful planets, and you get to the point where, okay, the pressure in the center is just enough for nuclear fusion to happen, so you get stars, and then it goes all the way up to big fellas.
Whenever you make a kind of a rule about something, though, you know, it's almost certain in science that someone's going to find that an exception to that one thing.
That's chemistry right there, right?
Especially when you tackle definitions as well.
Right.
Yes, yeah. And Pluto has made a very strange impact culturally as well.
Didn't they just find another thing orbiting for even further out that they think might be?
Well, there's the discussion of having a ninth planet, Planet X. And the reason is that you have a look at all the orbits of the planets in the solar system, and you can see that they're a bit off in terms of theoretical models and where they are. And actually, that's how Neptune was found. So Neptune was actually the only planet discovered in our solar system through math. And so a mathematician looked at the where Uranus was in the night sky and measured that out, and then did a theoretical model and found out that its orbit was actually a bit skew-iff. And did the calculations and was like, all right, well, I think with all these perturbations, there should be a planet about this size in the sky around about here. So they send that off to the Berlin Astronomy, Observatory. And lo and behold, on that same night that they got that letter, they discovered Neptune.
And isn't that
mind-blowing? It's just incredible. Absolutely incredible. And yet, 2 days later, they get another letter from another mathematician on the discovery of Neptune.
Saying the same basic thing. Well, that's like Darwin and Wallace, isn't it? You know, like those things have a time to be ready, you know. It's kind of weird.
Mm.
But it's because everybody's minds are prepared to the same level, you know, and you've got a lot of thinkers thinking. You're going to get to a certain level where there's ideas are percolating around, and someone goes, and someone else goes,
It's just a race to the finish.
No magic in it, you know.
Thank you all for joining me today. If any of our listeners would like to see more of what you're doing, could I just get you each to rattle off like we were doing midway through the show? But we'll start with Jake because you'd get a chance before. Is there anywhere we could see your work or your study, or if you have a social media presence or anything like that?
So I've got a Twitter. The handle is SpaceJake with an underscore. I guess, you know, with the USQ's Festival of Astronomy, that's going all the way through till next Monday. Mm-hmm. So tonight we have a talk from Fred Watson talking about the mysteries of the moon. I'd like to know whether or not it's made out of cheese, but I'm sure people would like to know a bit more serious questions around the moon. And then tomorrow night we have Professor Giovanna Tanetti from the University College of London talking about exoplanet atmospheres, so being able to detect atmospheres from exoplanets and trying to work out alien signatures from that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Monday night we have Doug Huggins, which is a senior scientist for the new planet finding telescope called TESS, which will be launched next year, and was also one of the chief scientists for the Kepler mission. And if there's any littlies listening in, or parents listening in, tomorrow I've also got a workshop where for ages 5 to 8, you can build your own planet using some Play-Doh and dance along to the solar system. So,
and are we going to be revisiting the Astronomy Festival next year as well?
It's definitely a thing. There's plans already about who we're going to have come along. Talks maybe looking at maybe someone from NASA and SpaceX and a few others. Probably not Elon, but we can always.
He might be a bit hard to pin down, yes. And yourself, Amy?
Yeah, so for any updates for the Science Centre or anything else Queensland Museum is doing, check out the Queensland Museum Network website. Something I didn't mention before that also may be of interest is the World Science Festival. That'll be on again in March next year and does have quite some wonderful talent and main stage events and salons that will be around the theme of Earth space science.
Can you get like a space haircut?
A space haircut?
With a salon? Oh, a different sort.
Yeah, different sort. But, you know, afterwards we can always get the clippers and have a go.
Yeah. Just get you a bowl cut, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And again, Scribbletronics?
Yes, my main website is scribbletronics.com. That's where you find out all of the stuff that I do. And the if you want to see a kind of a specialised science project, it's watchingeuropa.com. And you'll find lots of very interesting little pictures and sounds on that one.
And thank you all. I've been Mitch Drake, your host, and keep an eye on this space for more interesting USQ-centric podcasts.
Keep your eye on this space.
For more space!